Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday, Election Day. It's November 4th. Perfect weather to get out and vote. 44 degrees here in Old Town Park City. 43 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Election Day for the Wasatch Back. We're looking at plenty of sunshine, a couple of high clouds out there, but overall a very pleasant day expected. Temperatures will climb from the 30s into the low 60s in Park City this morning. We'll see those temperatures climbing into the mid-60s for us in the Heber Valley for our Tuesday afternoon. Again, it's going to be a beautiful day. No reason not to get out to the polls and no reason not to get out and enjoy the beautiful weather expected across the area. As we go into your Wednesday, look for a mixture of sun and clouds. We'll see some breezy conditions starting to develop as well. Temperatures will warm into the low 60s for us in Park City after starting out in the upper 30s. We'll see those temperatures dropping down to around freezing in the Heber Valley, but climbing into the mid to upper 60s for us as we go throughout our Wednesday afternoon. That cold front will begin to approach the area as we go into your Wednesday night, and on Thursday, that'll bring us a couple of scattered showers out there across the area for your Thursday morning. We'll see those temperatures in the mid to upper 30s, so most of that should be rain, but in some of the higher elevations above about 7,500 to 8,000 feet could have a few snow showers, not expecting major accumulations. Temperatures, though, for your Thursday, highs only in the 40s for us in Park City, with highs only in the low 50s for us in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Thursday night, we'll clear things out and dry things out at least a little bit. See temperatures dropping down into the 20s in the Heber Valley. We'll see those overnight lows dipping back into the low 30s in Park City. Partly cloudy skies are expected for us as we go throughout your Friday, with highs only in the low 50s in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures in the mid to upper 50s for us in the Heber Valley. And we're pretty much going to hold there with a mixture of sun and clouds throughout the weekend. It doesn't look terribly unsettled. We'll just have periods of clouds moving through the area. That's going to be primarily the main story, maybe an isolated sprinkle sometime Friday night into Saturday, but most of us will stay dry. Temperatures will be looking at highs in the 50s in Park City for you through the weekend, with highs in the 50s to low 60s in the Heber Valley. And we're all back into the 60s as we get towards next week with a mixture of sun and clouds. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Again, it is time. It's election day to vote for a host of municipal races across the Wasatch Back. Polls are open. They will close tonight at 8 p.m. For a full list of drop boxes in your area, you can go online to kpcw.org and have a look. Residents can vote in person at the Summit County Department of Health at Quinns Junction, the Camas Library, and Colville City Hall. In Wasatch County, in-person voting is taking place at the Wasatch County Administration Building at 25 North Main Street in Heber City. New this year, ballots sent by mail must reach election officials by election day, by today, or they won't be counted. Again, polls close at 8 o'clock. We'll be reporting results live on air and online as they come in, and we'll have more voting results and updates starting early Wednesday morning. The latest election information, again, will always be available online at kpcw.org. Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaum with a preview of this week's County Council meeting. Park City resident Bill Johnson with details about radon testing as part of National Lung Cancer Awareness Month. And from the Summit Land Conservancy, the CEO, Cheryl Fox, discussing some open space issues. Well, the Trump administration has placed new licensing restrictions on non-U.S. citizens who drive trucks and buses. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports is also affecting local livelihoods.
Several High Valley Transit and Park City Transit bus drivers are scrambling to change their immigration status or find another job this month after the federal rule change. The Trump administration made commercial driver's licenses off limits for certain people without permanent residency in the United States in September. The temporary change applies to drivers who are Canadian citizens, Mexican citizens, asylees, refugees, or deferred action for childhood arrivals recipients. Drivers with permanent residency are not affected. Trucking, bus driving, and other big rig jobs require CDLs. That means Park City area transit agencies are having to reshuffle staff.
We don't anticipate impact to our service. We're more concerned about the impact of these individuals. Again, they've been outstanding employees, and and we will do everything we can to make sure that they continue with meaningful employment.
High Valley Transit COO Brad Herkimer says 8 of his agency's drivers are affected, and only 3 will be able to change their immigration status in time to keep their jobs. Park City Transit is aware of the new CDL restrictions, but declined to say how many of its drivers are affected. City spokesperson Clayton Scrivener said in a statement they're working directly with any affected employees to ensure continuity of operations and prevent any service interruptions or delays. After the September 26th rule change, the Utah Driver's License Division sent letters to those who no longer qualify for what's called a non-domiciled CDL. According to a copy sent in October and obtained by KPCW, non-residents must have a passport and obtain either an H-2A, H-2B, or E-2 visa within 30 days of receiving the letter to retain their CDL, or they could pursue a green card. Otherwise, they'll only be allowed a regular driver's license. Herkimer says High Valley is coordinating with the company VIA, which runs High Valley's microtransit vans. Those no longer eligible to drive buses can join the micro fleet or drive smaller buses, and existing van drivers pursuing CDLs can restaff the fixed routes.
All 8 of these operators have been model employees. They show up on time. They work hard. They have great customer service. They've had 0 safety incidents with our buses and have just been great contributors to our service, and as a result, contributing to the overall good of our community in Park City.
The Trump administration adopted the new CDL rules for non-residents as an emergency measure, meaning it bypassed the regular public comment period. The Trump administration cited 5 fatal accidents involving non-domiciled CDL holders this year. The administration also claims there's systemic noncompliance with licensing rules across California, Colorado, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Texas, and Washington. Regulators have ordered California to suspend issuing all non-domiciled CDLs. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration estimates there are 200,000 non-domiciled CDL holders in the U.S., and that 194,000, 97%, will need to exit the market. The agency says there are 3.8 million total interstate CDLs, the specific type of license for trucking. Based on that, the FMCSA is not expecting a major economic hit from the new policy, but it did not look at bus drivers specifically. Before the interim regulation is official, the government is accepting public comment until midnight Eastern Time, November 28th. For more information, visit kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Wasatch County Council meets Wednesday, 4 o'clock. On the phone with a preview of the meeting is Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
So it's Election Day. Everything all set to go there in Wasatch County? Anything voters need to know?
Yeah, no, we're available to take ballots, and our downstairs meeting room is where people can come in, either from the north or, the east or the west side, to drop off any ballots or to vote in person.
Okay. Starting with the budget, the county council will go through a full draft budget at its meeting tomorrow. What are some of the biggest things to pay attention to here?
I think there's a few key areas to highlight. One of them is that we are making some investments in our road infrastructure. This is something that's, I think, we've been sitting on for a long time, and that we've had a lot of growth in the area, and many roads that Wasatch County builds within developments are private, but there are also public roads that the county is responsible to maintain. So over the last year, we did an inventory of the current status of a lot of these public roads and have identified that we need to be investing more money than what is available through our state-provided BNC road funds. So what we're looking at doing is contributing close to $1 million in perpetuity to make sure that we're staying on top of this road maintenance and we don't end up with older, more expensive to maintain infrastructure. It's always less expensive to maintain a road across its life than it is to simply let it decay and then have to rebuild it later.
Okay. What's the current plan for any tax increases next year?
So the only tax increase the council is considering is a parks and recreation increase. So the Wasatch County, the general fund, the library, the health department, all of those levies are not changing based on any truth and taxation increases. there is a request to fund 2 full-time positions and 1 part-time position in the Parks and Recreation Department. These 2 positions are maintenance crews in the event center and the Parks grounds, and the part-time position is a marketing position. All of these are related to our summer months are very busy, and we have a lot of staff and end up putting in a lot of overtime, and so we're hoping that by having additional staff, we end up saving some overtime expenses and ensuring that we can continue to deliver a high quality of service as our community continues to grow.
Okay, so that proposed tax increase at this point is how much?
It's about $236,000, and that would represent about a $7 a year increase on an average home in Wasatch County.
All right, and when does the public get involved? What, you got some public hearing scheduled?
Yeah, so we have a public hearing scheduled for the second Tuesday in December. And so we'll be talking about the budget. We'll be presenting the county's budget this Wednesday, and then talking about it in greater detail next Wednesday during our work meeting. So I think we'll have a lot more discussion about all of these things in public meetings, and then we have a required public hearing at that second Tuesday in December.
Okay, and why do you do it on a Tuesday when the meetings are traditionally Wednesday?
So Parks and Recreation is a special service district, and we actually have traditionally held those special service district meetings on Tuesdays. So the county meetings have been on Wednesdays, and those SSD meetings are on Tuesdays.
Okay. There's a public hearing this Wednesday for the planned impact fees for the Wasatch Fire District over the next 10 years. What does this mean for residents?
What it means is that we're ensuring that new homes are not being subsidized by existing residents. There are some updates to the costs of our impact fee study. Things that are capital investments as well as large vehicle purchases in excess of $1 million are things that we can include in those impact fees. And as the fire district's been building out facilities, we've crossed off a few things off the old list. So what we're doing is making sure that we're staying on top of current costs and current needs so that as new homes are built, they're the ones contributing to the increase in services necessary to meet those demands.
Now, has the fire district not been charging impact fees till now?
Oh, no, we have for some years. It's just we regularly try to update those impact fees to make sure that the list of projects has the accurate costs and includes the appropriate things within the time window. Impact fees are something that we are required and we do take very seriously because there is a cost, right? When someone wants to buy a new home, they have to pay an impact fee. So we have a very robust process that we are required to go through to make sure that we can justify the fees that we're paid. We use Zions Bank at both the county and the fire district to help us provide that analysis. And so we have to spend those funds within about 6 years. And so we have to regularly update that list of projects and the amounts that we are charging in those impact fees.
All right. Wasatch County thinking about buying 200 acres of private land near Wallsburg. Why is that?
So this is actually the DWR looking at buying those because this is adjacent to the Wallsburg Wildlife Management Area. What they're requesting is Wasatch County provide a letter of support. Typically, Wasatch County is very supportive of our open space preservation, access to our agricultural land for hunting purposes and other things like that. So we've provided these in the past. In some of those other instances, they have been a little bit smaller in holdings in some of these state or lands. This one, I think, is a little bit bigger than normal, but I expect the county council to be supportive of DWR's request.
Yeah, so if the land is to be acquired by the DWR, why is this a council issue? Just they need the letter?
So actually, DWR is required to inform councils whenever they do purchase property so that we can provide input on, you know, on these things. Again, I think Wasatch County is generally supportive of these changes. So they're not required to get a letter of support from us, but they have asked for it. And like I said, we've provided them in the past. So that's really, they're ticking a box on the state requirement to inform us at a public meeting of this purchase. And we're also being good partners by providing that letter of support.
Okay, it says that the property is to be used for wildlife conservation and wildlife recreation. What's wildlife recreation?
I think they're referring to hunting activities that take place within that wildlife management area.
Well, if you're trying to conserve wildlife, why would you hunt them?
I think it's an interesting dichotomy that there are a lot of hunters who are actually very concerned about the sustainability of hunting. And that's part of why we have a wildlife management area, so that we can ensure that wildlife continue to be able to reproduce and expand so that hunting activities can continue. If hunters hunt unregulated and, say, significantly impact the population of wildlife, then they don't get to hunt anymore. So I think there is actually a really useful balance, and the fees that hunters pay go to help pay for this conservation and mitigation. So I think one of the alternatives that many places use is no regulation and no limits, and I think that would be far less sustainable than a sustainable hunting plan.
So who's responsible for managing this 200 acres?
It's the DWR as part of that wildlife management area. I think people will be most familiar with it if they ever drive along 189 between Heber and Provo, that Walsburg turn, that whole area kind of to that east side is all part of that wildlife management area there.
All right, let's see, moving on to the Trails, Arts, and Parks grants. The County Council will be reviewing recommendations for 15 grants for the fall grant cycle. Can you talk to us a little bit about what kind of projects are asking for funding?
Yeah, these projects span some park improvements. We are also have a lot of arts programs, a lot of performing arts. The Girl in the Yellow Dress is a performance that was done down in Utah County and is actually done by Heber City young residents and is now coming to Wasatch County, so that's one of them. And there are other arts and charitable events. Wasatch County requires that any of these applicants be a nonprofit organization, and our board, our TAP advisory board, provides some oversight on ratings and recommendations for how much to fund and which things Wasatch County does and does not fund associated with these types of requests.
Okay, so what I read was that pretty much everybody who asked for money got money except for the girl with the yellow dress, and that was because I had read that the application was incomplete, but you're telling me because it wasn't a nonprofit?
No, I think there are certain criteria that have to be met. I think we're hoping that they'll come back in the spring grant cycle to be able to apply for future funds. But really, we have an established criteria that does include nonprofit. This one was a nonprofit, but there are other things in that criteria that make sure that we have to have enough information to evaluate the grant. And I think in that one case, that one fell a little bit short.
All right. So how often are these grants issued?
So Wasatch County's been doing a semi-annual grant award. We have been doing one in the spring and one in the fall. And not all of the projects get funded, or not all of them get funded 100%. But we have been in the position where we've been building up some of those reserves so that we can fund future projects as they come in. So twice a year, really.
Yeah. And how much grant money is going to be issued this fall?
I believe it's just under $400,000 is kind of the total that we're looking at awarding.
Okay. And again, that comes from 1% tax?
Yeah. So there is a Trails, Art, and Parks sales tax that was approved by voters a few years ago. Wasatch County splits that between Heber City, unincorporated Wasatch County, covering some of the other smaller communities as well, and Midway City. So Wasatch County gets about 35% of that total, and actually $400,000 is close to what we get on an annual basis, but we had some excess funds available, and the previous grant award process, some of those grants actually backed out and said that they weren't able to continue with their event, and so we didn't need to fund them.
Okay. Off the top of your head, what are some of the biggest successes of this TAP tax grant program so far in your mind?
I think there's a lot. We have a lot of really amazing art amenities that we have been able to fund. We have contributed to some skate park improvement and pavilions at the parks. We've been using these funds to support trails around the county in Walsburg. And in some of the state parks, we've been supporting the Wasatch Trails Foundation using these funds. And all of those we feel like really closely align with who we are as a community and the types of events we want to see here.
All right. So the next round of funding will be again next spring then?
Yes. Yeah, we typically put out in January information about the next grant cycle if we make any adjustments to the criteria and give people, you know, somewhere in the range of 6 weeks to apply.
Okie doke. Let's see. On Wednesday's agenda, there are some proposed changes to the county's records management and privacy packages practices. What will these changes do?
So this is in response to a state code change from, I believe, last year that all public entities are required to adopt basically privacy standard management plan. And so this is Wasatch County's effort to step into that process. I can't like undersell that this is a really big and important project that affects all local governments across the state of Utah. What we're trying to do is work with the state on ensuring that the information that we collect from the public is protected in a way that the public is aware of and comfortable with, and is we are transparent about how and what we use data for. So what this does is establishes the first major steps in adopting that process, appointing a chief executive officer over privacy and data. And we are in the process of basically taking an inventory of the data we're collecting so that we can disclose that to the public and ensure that we're treating it appropriately.
Okay. So again, you're doing this because the state's requiring it.
Yeah. And I think it's something that is an interesting balance because many of the things the county does, we do specifically to disclose it. For instance, property records, right? That all counties have a recorder's office that discloses who owns which properties. And that's a major function that they have. But that puts kind of some pressure on privacy and what is the balance of those things. And so that's where the state has been wading in to try and ensure that we err on the side of privacy as much as possible.
All right. You have a recommendation for a new member of the Deputy Sheriff's Merit Commission. Who's this person?
Charles Huick is someone who applied. We had four applicants for the Deputy Sheriff's Merit Commission. He has an extensive career as a federal law enforcement officer and is currently serving as a law enforcement trainer for Forest Service law enforcement officers in Colorado, but is retiring from that. So we felt like he was a really valuable pick, provided some law enforcement background that the other two existing members of our Merit Commission didn't have, and will be a great asset to our Merit Commission process as we continue to try and update and apply the changes as recommended by Judge McKelvey's report.
All right. And finally, a victims' rights committee said yesterday that the county attorney's office and sheriff's office may have violated the rights of Patrick Hayes' family. He's the man, of course, who was killed in a road rage shooting near Jordan-Hale State Park last year. So what happens now?
I'm not exactly familiar with the provisions of that victim's claim. I do know that we have done as much as we can to ensure that we're including information to the public. We actually just put out a statement yesterday trying to explain a little bit more about why Wasatch County is charging what we did and some of the context around that. And so I think we're trying to be as transparent as possible. I think there are a lot of nuance when it comes to a complicated case like this, though.
Yeah, have you seen the complaint?
I haven't. I haven't read through it in detail. I know our attorneys have, and I talked with our attorneys briefly about it, but I'm not familiar with the details of that process or the claims in of themselves.
Okay. Anything else, Dustin?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, non-smoking lung cancer survivors are working to raise awareness and increase radon testing in Utah. In the studio to tell us more and what to look for is Park City resident Bill Johnson. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Leslie.
Start by just telling us a little bit about your story and how you got to this point in your life as a radon testing advocate.
Yeah, well, in 2023, in June of 2023, I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer that had metastasized through my spine, into my hip, and up into my brain. And so after a long battle with that, I came out of it, and having a terminal diagnosis really inspired me to just educate the public on lung cancer awareness and radon, and specifically because after I was diagnosed, I was kind of left there searching. You know, I wasn't an avid smoker. I didn't really smoke at all ever, and just kind of shell-shocked at how I ended up being diagnosed with lung cancer. And after doing a lot of research, I found out something that I, you know, the public probably doesn't really know is that the second leading cause of lung cancer and the leading cause among non-smokers is radon. And so really just trying to educate the public on radon testing, mitigation, and yeah, that's it. It's really just trying to make a difference with this terminal diagnosis.
Yeah, so what were your symptoms?
I didn't have the consistent, you know, the typical symptoms of lung cancer, right? Consistent cough or anything like that. It was, for me, you know, during that winter of 2022 that was really big, I was shoveling my driveway and I pulled out my back and I just thought, oh God, you know, I'm 42 at the time going, hey, I pulled out my back, no big deal. But after it consistently kept hurting and hurting and getting worse, it finally gave out. And that's when I went to, got an MRI and it showed. So it's a significant problem.
Yeah, and so that you were feeling the cancer perhaps from your spine as opposed to your lungs at that point, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it had gotten so bad at diagnosis that, you know, my vertebrae were essentially crumbling and my hip was, you know, the bone was essentially so compromised that I could barely walk. So I ended up having to get a full spinal fusion to stabilize my back, and then that's when we went in and attacked the cancer with radiation and targeted treatment therapy.
Yeah. You know. So had you ever tested your home for radon?
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. You know, so I purchased our home 15 years ago now, but and we got a test when we purchased our home, and we just tested then, let it go, right? But, you know, 13 years of working from home, essentially, and in a lower-level room of my house, I never even thought to test again. You know, I thought, you test, we're good, let's live our life. And I think it's, you know, part of the message here is to test often because the levels change consistently, right?
Yeah, that's what's interesting about this, because radon is found naturally in the earth.
Yeah, yeah, it's essentially, you know, uranium deposits in the soil that decay, and then when those deposits decay, they turn into a radioactive gas, radon, and then it finds its way to seep, you know, finds ways to seep into your house. And in, here in Park City, with our mining history, you know, we have kind of built-in conduits, right? So, and then if, you know, say your neighbor's remodeling or you're going to do an addition to your house and the soil gets disturbed, you know, that can provide more, a new conduit and impact, you know, your home and your radon levels.
Hmm. So what about your family members? I mean, they were living there with you, just not in the lower level all the time.
Yeah, right? And I think that's kind of the big thing, you know. So my, you know, my wife didn't work from home, and the kids are always out doing stuff, so they haven't been impacted, fingers crossed at this point. But you know, I did work from home and I spent a significant time, you know, on a daily basis in there.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, would you know if radon is to blame?
I think for me personally, I don't know yet. I think science is still evolving, and certain mutations of lung cancer, do show signs of certain impacts, but for me personally, no, I don't know, but I know there's lots of people that can confirm, you know. When I was previously on the show with you, Connie, she tested her home, and she lived in Camas for a long time, and her home tested at 13 picocuries per liter, which is the measurement tool that the EPA uses to regulate radon gas, and so she really felt that with her lifestyle, that was the cause.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Connie passed in May, so I'm sorry about that. She was again on with you last year, just talking about it. That equivalent of the picocuries that you said is like smoking more than a pack of cigarettes a day.
Yeah, I mean, it's very impactful, and I, you know, there's other survivors that I work with at UtahRadon.org that have had levels in Lehigh of 30. And 20s, and so all over the state, this is a major impact. And we're even finding with, you know, that 49% of our homes in the state of Utah are having high levels. And really what high means is, you know, the EPA sets it at, you know, above 4 you need to mitigate, and actually they recommend at 2.7 to mitigate. So to have levels at 13 and in the 20s and 30s is pretty significant.
Okay, and that's what the test will tell you, what that amount
yeah.
is.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can go to utahradon.org to order a free test. We provide that. The Utah Department of Environmental Quality also has set tests available to purchase. And then my personal, I personally use a monitor, which you can purchase on Amazon. And I use a company called EcoCube or EcoSense. And that way you can measure throughout the day, because what I find, which is really interesting, is that in my home and in other homes that have this monitor, is, you know, in the fall, suddenly the levels will rise. Or perhaps in the middle of the night, all of a sudden it rises. And so it has, like, there's so many variables, right? If you're not having adequate ventilation in your house, it's staying stagnant within the house. And so just really important to test and mitigate when you can.
All right. So is once a year enough testing, you think?
I mean, I personally advocate for a monitor, or quarterly testy, or biannually at least. I think you should test in the winter and the summer at a minimum, right? Because of the variables, right? So when I tested, when I was diagnosed, my brother came up to the house and tested, or my brother and my wife tested the house, you know, it was summertime, so it was well ventilated, so the levels were very low. And then when I came home in October, all of a sudden it skyrocketed in that room. So test often.
Yeah. And again, people can just go to utahradon.org. Again, I think you get one free test kit. You can also purchase them, I know, at Summit County Health Department for a minimal fee.
Yeah. And there's good resources on that site as well. It's right, educating you on radon, mitigation resources, and various things. So, yeah.
Okay. And from Utah Radon, I was told that 71% of Park City homes tested for radon since 2016 do have levels higher than the EPA standard. So it's not something to mess around with.
No, it's definitely not. It's present. And, you know, being diagnosed with lung cancer is very impactful in so many ways, but testing is a very low-cost way to prevent and be aware of what's going on in your environment. So it's really low-hanging fruit, right? The alternative is awful.
Yeah. And what's the mitigation if you do have high limits?
Yeah. Hiring a professional, a certified professional, is key. And the price range, you know, it's from $800 to $2,500, depending on, you know, how bad it is and how your house is configured. But essentially, it's a way to pipe, you know, the radon out of your house, right? In the most simplistic form, right? Whether that, how that fan and vent is placed depends on your house, but it's essentially a way to get that air out of your house and provide healthy air circulation.
All right, and that would usually be done at like the lowest level of the home?
Correct, mm-hmm. Yeah, and then piped out of your, at the highest point, if
okay.
possible.
All right, let's see. I guess what else that is important that people know?
I just think testing, consistently is key, right? And understanding that the environment around you, like I said, you know, if there's new construction going around your home, test, right? Because that may impact your levels within your home. And just be aware of your surroundings and consistently test in the house, because the alternative is no fun.
Okay. And again, radon, like carbon monoxide, it's odorless, it's colorless, you just don't know it's there.
Yeah. Exactly.
So your prognosis, is that you're stable at this point?
I'm stable at this point. I think I've gone through various iterations. So Connie, both of us were on a targeted therapy initially, and my cancer has progressed three times at this point. And we found, you know, the hope here is that the medical field is so advanced at this point where they can find the specific mutation you have and treat it with targeted therapy. So I've taken, you know, I've started with one targeted therapy pill, and then I moved and added a whole nother sector to it and another set of pills, and it's kept the cancer at bay. I have had to do radiation a few times, but right now I'm doing okay. I'm physically disabled at this point because of, you know, my skeletal system. So I physically, but mentally I'm here.
Good. So. Well, you're looking good too, Bill.
Thanks.
All right. Take care. Appreciate your time. Again, people can get more information at utahradon.org as well as a free household test kit.
Yep. Thank you.
Well, Summit County Republican leaders say that a text message circulating on social media that appears to endorse Park City mayoral candidate Jack Rubin and Jeremy Rubel for city council didn't come from the Republican Party. In a news release, party chairman Ari Ioannidis said they don't know the source of the GOP voting alert message, which was sent via text messages Monday night. Ioannidis said the message was not authorized by the party, its leaders, or either campaign. He wrote, "We believe this message may have been sent by bad actors attempting to mislead voters and to manipulate the election by creating the false appearance of Republican involvement." Ioannidis said the party has not endorsed any candidates in the nonpartisan municipal election. He also urged voters to ignore the text and only rely upon official information from the campaigns, election officials, or independent sources before casting their ballots today. Summit County Democratic Party leaders said they had no involvement or knowledge of the text message. Chairman Rory Swenson encouraging local Republican leaders to refer the message to state election officials for investigation. This is a developing story and will be updated when more information is available. In the studio now with an update from the Summit Land Conservancy, I have CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you weren't there, but I'm sure you've heard. How did the clothing optional fundraiser go for you?
Clothing Optional is always one of our best events. We're so fortunate to partner with Top of Maine, the brew pub at the Top of Maine called Top of Maine, not only for the party, but also for the creation of the wonderful Clothing Optional Wild Hops Ale every year. And this year we had only a little over, I think, 70 pounds of hops, wild hops, but the flavor really came through. I just love that sort of green, herby flavor from the wild hops. And so we did. We had a sellout crowd. People were super supportive, and it's always a great time.
All right. Let's see. What's the latest with your family ranch that you've been working on?
We've been working with Summit County and the Ure family for a few years now to, finalize the conservation easements on that property. And as we went through the process, we realized that there were going to be 5 separate conservation easements because there are different uses proposed for different parts of the property, and eventually probably different owners, different people who will come in and become the farmers or ranchers on those properties. So there are 5 separate easements. We're working on all 5. 2 of them do involve federal funding. One uses Land and Water Conservation Fund, and that will have recreational access. The other does use Agricultural Land Easement Program funding from the federal government. All of that money has been obligated, and it is all, it's basically sitting in the bank in Utah and is ready to be released once the government reopens. So we are hopeful that we will be able to get all of those easements done so that the county can complete its purchase of the year property as proposed by the end of 2025.
The way it's going doesn't sound like that might happen.
I know, but it's still, I think the county should really be applauded for taking the leap and jumping into to purchase that 800 acres from the Ure family at the south end of the Camas Valley. It's beautiful, and it's such a big parcel of agricultural land that it really does tend to tip the scale so that other agricultural producers can stay in business out in that region. And, of course, we're incredibly grateful to the Ure family for working with the county on that.
Okay. Let's see. You have 2 other projects in Summit County that also have federal funding involved. So those
That's
two
right.
are on hold?
Those two, again, the money has been obligated, so it's just ready to be released. One is in rangeland above Hoytsville, and the other is actually in the Camas Valley. We're ready to go if the government reopens. It's going to be a challenge to see. I know they're going to be very busy when they finally reopen. They're going to have quite a backlog of things to do. So we're hopeful that we'll be able to get these things closed. Again, because we're a certified entity, it means that, we don't have to wait in line for the National Appraisal Review or the National Survey Review or the National Title Review. We can do all that in-house. So we have the potential to get these things closed. It just depends.
Yeah, and I guess, since it's fiscal 2025 dollars, why the holdup? Just because there's nobody there to
there's
send
nobody
a check?
There to push the button, mm-hmm.
All right,
the pay button.
So, in terms of these 2 additional projects, what are we talking about in terms of acreage?
It's about It's over pretty close to 3,000 acres on just those two. Just those two easements. And then we have other easements that don't involve federal funding for about another 1,800 acres that we do think we will be able to get closed before the end of the year. Part of that is an easement donation up by Snow Basin. And then we have a couple of other projects with Oakley City and some with Midway. So we have plenty of things to do. A broad portfolio of conservation projects, which is important, right? Because we know that sometimes government priorities shift or change, or they just shut their doors for, you know, a little while. And it's important for us to be able to continue moving forward with conservation.
Okay, so what's happening in Oakley City?
Oakley City owns a property on Pinyon Lane. It's actually on both sides of Pinyon Lane. It's where they have a bike park, and they want to put a conservation easement on the part that is to the east of Pinyon Lane, so sort of uphill from Pinyon Lane. This will protect the trail access. It will protect the view. It's sort of the eastern slope of the Uintas right there. Is it the western slope? Anyway, it's the slope of the Uintas. That property eventually can connect up into the Forest Service. And it also, on a portion of the property, protects Oakley's watershed. And that is an important criteria for this conservation easement. So it's about 80 acres, and there will be a public access recreational component on a portion of the property, and then there will be very limited access to the watershed area because, you know, again, even people hiking often come with dogs, and that's not the best for your watershed.
Yeah. So whatever happened to the Green Cemetery you were hoping to put in Oakley?
We were looking to do that on the other portion of the parcel that will not be under easement with this particular transaction. There were concerns from some residents in Oakley about how that would play out. And we felt, or I guess the city council over there felt like, you know, let's just go ahead and put an easement on the eastern portion of Pinyon Lane, because we really do want to make sure that that is protected forever for the watershed and for the recreational access. And we'll have further discussions about whether or not they want to move forward with a conservation cemetery.
All right. In Wasatch County, you're watching what Heber City and the county plans to do with a conservation easement there. What are your concerns with that?
Our concerns are that there was a development agreement in about 2007. It's big. It's 8,500 acres. And there was, you know, during that development agreement, one of the public benefits was a large tract of land, about 5,000 acres, that would not be developed and would be set aside for open space, view shed, recreational uses. We were contacted in 2021 to hold a conservation easement on that open space. And there were some things that had to be figured out. You know, who eventually owns the land? Right now, the developer owns the land, but when the developer's done building houses, you know, they move on. So who ends up holding the land? So we had some suggestions that eventually they took. And anyway, as it moved through the process, Heber City annexed that development into Heber City, so they became sort of having more control. Wasatch County, however, was the initial grantor of the or partner in the development agreement, so Wasatch County wanted to make sure that the things that they secured in their development agreement continued to be in place. So, you know, we had a number of conversations over the years, and about a year and a half ago, it became apparent that maybe they weren't going to use an accredited land trust to hold the open space conservation easement. So, you know, we have a number of concerns about that just on principle. But, you know, a city could hold a conservation easement if they wanted to. So they have drafted an agreement. We have concerns about that agreement, which we made public at a meeting a couple weeks ago over in Heber. It might be a little too late because Heber City already approved it. Our main concerns are that the agreement that they have crafted does not list what they're trying to protect. It says, here's a bunch of things you can do, but it doesn't say, you know, we're trying to protect viewshed or public access. And 50 years from now, when a new use is proposed, you know, you have to go through and say, wow, you know, are hovercraft bicycles allowed on these trails? And you have to be able to go back and say, well, what were they really trying to do? What was the purpose here? So we have suggested that maybe their agreement include a purpose. There's also no term in the agreement, so, you know, that says this is meant to be perpetual or for 30 years or whatever, and that is actually required by the state statute for conservation easements, so we had asked that they add a term, like how long is it supposed to last? And then I think, you know, finally, one of our concerns is who stewards this easement? It's not the HOA's responsibility to steward their own easement. If you ask them to do that, you're essentially requiring the HOA, you know, the people who don't even own homes up there right now, to be responsible for securing the public benefit of their own, for the whole county, right? For anybody who goes up and uses the trails. Or, so you can't ask the HOA, and also, the HOA is eventually going to become the landowner. And it's not a great idea to have the landowner enforcing the conservation easement either, right? Because that's, you know, the fox guarding the hen house. And so I think that we wanted Heber City to understand that if they are the holder of the conservation easement, it is their responsibility to steward it. And that means making sure that the terms of the conservation easement are upheld. It means making sure that there are no encroachments by, you know, neighbors or third parties on the, you know, boundaries of the property. And, you know, that's a real job, and that's what an accredited land trust is set up to do. And so I just wanted the, you know, Heber City Council to understand that if they are the holders of the easement, that is a responsibility that they are undertaking and their taxpayers will pay for.
Yeah. So is the vagueness of this conservation easement intentional, or is it just ignorance?
I can't speak to that. I don't know. You know, we were not involved in the drafting of that document at all. I don't know. I don't know why they decided not to use an accredited land trust. You know, we're still in meetings and talking about it, so it is the decision of the elected officials as to whether or not they're going to decide to go with an accredited land trust to hold the document. You know, every time an accredited land trust takes a new conservation easement, we also have to find what we call stewardship funding. You know, you and I have talked about this before. That is a lump of money, a one-time lump of money that is set aside forever. And we can use the interest from that money to pay staff to annually visit the property, meet with the landowner. You know, we feel like we're partners in this going forward to say, hey, you know, you've got this great thing going on over there, maybe something over here. You know, we find encroachments on our landowners' open space all the time by neighbors. You know, somebody inadvertently drives a skid steer across an easement or builds a patio on land that they don't own. And usually, you know, because we're out there and we're looking at all the boundaries, we're the ones that often bring this to the attention of the landowner. And then it's, you know, it's the city's responsibility to go and say, hey, you have to move your patio or things like that. So, but these are very real jobs. But because we set aside money up front, we're not going back to the taxpayer and saying, hey, you have to pay for this. Also, because we are a charity and we are able to bring philanthropy to the table, right? Our fees are much lower than a for-profit business has to be, because a for-profit business or even the city, not only do they have to pay for the staff time, but all the overhead and all the background and, you know, workers' compensation and things that you have to pay. We're able to cover a lot of those costs because we're a charity and because individuals support our work.
Yeah. I guess what I was hearing, though, from Heber City is that they don't need an accredited land trust because there aren't any tax benefits with this property.
So the Summit Land Conservancy holds thousands of acres under conservation easement with Park City Municipal. We're about to hold some with Oakley City. None of those have tax benefits. In fact, we hold a number of easements on also, you know, that are also required by development agreements where there is no IRS tax component. There are, you know, 1,000 acres under easement up at Deer Valley where there is public access, where there is skiing. There was no tax benefit in any of those. So, whether or not there's an IRS benefit doesn't matter.
Okay. Cheryl, anything else you want to mention?
I just think that, you know, we're really fortunate that we have so much support from individuals, and we're so lucky to be here and able to share all the good work that we're doing on KPCW. So thank you.
Okay. Cheryl Fox is the CEO of Summit Land Conservancy.